Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. With me today are two academics whose areas of study would appear, prima facie, to be far removed from each other. But today we shall discover that appearances can sometimes be misleading. Dr. Josette Camilleri is a dentist by profession, but if you search her on the university website, you'll find her in the Department of Building and Civil Engineering, Faculty for the Built Environment. That was, until recently, the Faculty of Architecture and Civil Engineering. After becoming a dentist, Dr. Camilleri worked as a clinician in the public service for some years, then went to do an MPhil in collaboration with King's College London, after which she read for her PhD, also with King's and the University of Malta, where she specialised in materials. Professor Joseph Grimo, on the other hand, read for a BSc here in Malta, and then followed this with a PhD from Exeter in the UK, specialising in materials science. So there, at least, we can anticipate a bit of a connection. Professor Grima is someone who can be described as a scientist who wears various hats. Sometimes he's a chemist, sometimes he works as a physicist, and sometimes also as a mathematician, depending on the occasion and the work that he's doing. He returned to Malta to the Department of Chemistry and the Faculty of Science and has done pioneering work in the area of auxetics, which is something we shall be speaking about later. Welcome to you both. Dr. Camilleri, I turn to you just using the ladies first principle, really. I did a little bit of reading in preparation for this interview, and I was interested to see that a material which one would normally associate with the construction industry could be of interest to a dentist. How was this connection discovered?
Well, basically, this connection was discovered in America about more than 10 years ago, when somebody was actually building a house and the concrete was getting wet. And this person, Professor Mahmoud Torabinejad, was really worried because his concrete was getting wet, until the builders told him that it is perfectly okay because Portland cement develops its properties when wet. Our main problem as dentists is basically that we cannot get any of our materials wet. So he thought that by using this Portland cement in dentistry, he could get this problem sorted out.
I see. And you've been actually testing and working on this particular area for some time. What is the research project itself based on?
It is based on developing a better material, because the basic material had a very, very long setting time. It took long to set, obviously, for concreting industry. You need a material which sets in about 3 hours, which we cannot afford that on a dental chair. You cannot keep the patient there for a long while, because obviously they get upset. Nobody likes the dental chair. So we are developing the material by increasing the physical properties, meaning the strength, reducing the setting time and making it more suitable.
And are there other things like other aspects to look at, like how much does it cost? I mean, is it a cheap thing to use, this Portland cement, or not?
In the construction industry, it is very, very cheap, because you can buy a sack of 50 kilos for a few pounds. Unfortunately, in dentistry, it has been sold even for 50 Maltese pounds per gram. It is a very, very expensive material, and I have to say, it is the same material. It is plain and simple Portland cement with some bismuth oxide added, so it can be seen on X-ray. But the cost has been inflated to make it look important.
So when you say that this material has these special properties, that it's bioactive, what exactly does that mean? What does it mean to the cement? What makes it different then from other materials?
Yes, basically, this material is not being used exactly in the mouth. It is used in surgical sites. It was an incidental finding. They placed the material there because it was okay to get it wet. It was okay to get it contaminated with blood, but once they looked at the microscope, under the microscope, at this material, they found that this material induced bone to form. you get a bone fill over the material. So if you have a surgical defect and you place the material, you get bone growing over this material. They didn't know why. The initial researchers, that was the main idea of my research. I wanted to know what is going on with this material. So my main area of research was the hydration mechanism and what byproducts we get from this material. This Portland cement produces a lot of calcium hydroxide, which makes the material extremely alkaline. And this is what the body and the bone wants, a very alkaline material where you get deposition of bone around the material.
So this was the aim of your research, to find this new applications for this material.
Yes, certainly.
And how do you go about testing this sort of thing?
We did various tests. We first and foremost, we had to repeat some of the tests that were initially done on the material, because we had problems with contamination of the initial samples and so on. People didn't realize it was so reactive. We studied a lot of the biological properties, but then eventually we proceeded in testing the properties of the materials per se, testing what, how the radioopacifier acted on the material, and improving the material properties like strength. We added some other materials like fillers and so on, making it into a more complicated material. We started producing a dental composite, not the proper dental composite, but a new composite made up of different components that would make the material a better material.
And research like this, I would imagine, necessitates having partners at a very high level. So who else is actually involved in this research?
Actually, I was everywhere for my PhD, and even now I worked a lot with the different departments at the University of Malta. I had a very, very big opportunity of working elsewhere, places like Imperial College, the Department of Materials, where they have a very, very good setup to study all types of materials. And I worked at Bristol University, and I even worked at EPFL in Switzerland. They have a laboratory which is specialized in Portland cements. And I have found basically that the more input you get from different fields, the more interesting it becomes, because you get interdisciplinary ideas and you get people who know nothing on your subject but know something about the material, who can input a lot of ideas.
It's sort of part of this idea of the scholar being somewhere in a closed room on his or her own, of course, is rubbish, really.
That is exactly rubbish.
And what about future plans? How are you going to move on with this research?
Obviously, I will continue with my collaborations abroad. I have some new partners who are very, very interested in this research. I mean, now I've become a popular name, with this material. So I actually got approached by a few partners from University of Cardiff, and most probably I will take up even some partners from Italy, because the Italians were even interested in this material. But what I intend to do is opening up new collaborations with other people who are testing materials at the University of Malta. Basically, there is the chemistry department, where obviously they test the chemical interactions, and that is very interesting for me, and obviously the Department of Engineering, the Faculty of Engineering, where they have a setup where they test various materials, and I can include my research with their research and even have inter-collaboratory work done at the University of Malta.
Well, you've mentioned the Department of Chemistry, so I think we can move in that direction then and pick up the conversation with Professor Grima. Professor, in this particular case, you've been working on a material which is something new but not so new. Tell us about it.
Well, exactly. What we work on is, we've all got the idea of stretching a rubber band. When you stretch a rubber band, you see it getting thinner. Basically, everything behaves more or less in this way, glass, plastics, metals. But we knew for a very long time that theory tells us that it is possible for a material to actually become fatter. But nobody had actually seen any of these materials. And towards the end of the 1980s, there were a number of groups in Europe and in the US who were trying to see, well, can we really get a material which does not become thinner, which becomes fatter? And there were some interesting pioneering work, especially by Rod Lakes in the States, Wojciechowski in Poland, and Ken Evans in Exeter, who actually coined the word oxetics, who actually proved for the very first time, because they actually produced excellent models or manufacturing some materials, that can actually exhibit this unusual behavior, that you stretch it and become fatter. And basically, unless you see it for the first time in front of you, you wouldn't believe it, that there is a possibility that rather than stretching a rubber band and seeing it becoming thinner, there are materials which you stretch them and they actually become fatter.
Well, the meaning of the word auxetics, and I know this because I looked it up, of course, is from Greek auxitos, meaning to enlarge or to expand.
Exactly.
And the gentleman who discovered it gave it a name as mm-hmm. as well. And it is very counterintuitive, isn't it, this idea?
It is, because basically all materials we normally see around us do not have this property. I mean, something which comes close to auxetics is cork, because cork, like what we used in bottle stoppers, has got doesn't get thinner nor fatter. In fact, whether it becomes thinner or fatter, we describe it through the Poisson's ratio. If something gets thinner, then it will have a positive Poisson's ratio. It gets fatter, it will have a negative Poisson's ratio. Cork has got a Poisson's ratio of zero. So the thing which we are all familiar with, sort of, to a certain extent is like an auxetic, but not exactly an auxetic, is cork, because cork does not become thinner, neither fatter. And this is why it's very good to be used in bottles, because basically when you are trying to compress it to close the bottle, it goes in quite easily, and at the same time when you're trying to pull it out, it also comes out rather easily.
Well, before just going on to discuss some applications and a little bit more about this fascinating kind of material, I'd just like to remind listeners that this is Research Matters on Campus FM, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm talking today to Dr. Josette Camilleri and to Professor Joseph Grima. So, Professor, we were talking about these materials. They do occur naturally, as you were saying, in the natural world. You mentioned the idea of the cork being the nearest to it, but there are biomaterials which are auxetic.
Exactly. Although we can't actually see it very much, our skin is auxetic. It's auxetic in its thickness, and this property is basically extremely important given the extreme conditions that our skin has to endure. Something else which is also naturally occurring, which is auxetic, are some crystals like zeolites and silicates, which we know that they are auxetic. And something else which is, because auxetics, they can be either a material on a small scale, but you also can have auxeticity on a larger scale. And it's very interesting, there are actually some leaves which are folded in such a way that when you stretch these leaves, they will actually expand. So, and in fact, leaves, nature uses this mechanism when the leaf is opening up. So the leaf would have been in a folded state that when something is stretched, it will open up. But it's also not very difficult to make them. Basically, the first material which was produced from a normal material to make it auxetic was foam. And if you want to make auxetic foam, it's really easy. All you need to do is to take a normal piece of foam, compress it to about 30% of its volume, put it in an oven at around 180-190 degrees, leave it there for about 20 minutes, cool it down and in the compressed state, and when you take it out of the box, you will have an auxetic foam. So the idea is that basically we started with something normal, we crumpled it up and froze it in that way, and it has become auxetic.
The idea of this foam is a nice one, and we'll take your word for it that that's what happens when you do those various processes with it. Originally, there must have been some reason for doing it, or reason for looking for something, for man-made materials that actually have this particular property. Was there something that the scientists were looking for, a particular way of using something like this foam that you've described?
Auxetics are interested because they are unusual. So anything which is unusual will look as interesting, and in fact they are interesting. But apart from being interesting because they are unusual, they are also extremely useful, these materials. The simplest thing that I can think of at the moment is, for example, what if we would have an auxetic nail? So imagine an auxetic nail, I'm trying to hammer it into a wall. When I'm hammering my nail, if it's auxetic, then when I'm pressing it in, it is actually becoming thinner. So it would be easier for the nail to go into my brick. if I'm trying to pull it, then the nail will become fatter. So it does not want to dislocate from the brick. So we have a smart nail up to a certain point that is very easy to hammer, but it's very easy to take out again. So it's a much better nail. Foams are interesting because of two other very useful properties of oxetics. One of them is that it is that oxetics, they have a better ability to resist indentation. So if I'm trying to compress something, what usually happens is, if I'm pressing on something, is that the material spreads out from where I'm pressing. So effectively, if I'm sitting on a seat, then what happens is that the foam under me would be going towards the end and I would not be given that much protection. Oxetics, by their nature, instead of becoming thinner under you, they are actually becoming more compact. So that is offering you much better resistance and much more comfort. And another, in this respect, because of comfort, is that they have a natural ability to form shapes which are like a dome. And because our body parts are basically all dome-shaped, then if we have seats, for example, car seats, which are in the made from oxetic materials, then they are able to give us a much more comfortable sit than normal materials. Mm-hmm. Something else which we're working on is, for example, their use as filters. Because what happens is that when you have an oxetic material, what is really happening inside is that when you're stretching it, there are pores in it normally that are becoming wider. So there we have a mechanism whereby by just simply stretching a material, we can increase the pore size of our materials. And this is extremely useful in filters, in smart filters. For example, if we want filters where we can fine-tune the size of the pores, in applications where we do not want our filters to get blocked. And also, for example, there's been a very interesting piece of work done in the UK whereby you take an oxetic material, you fill it up with biologically active ingredients, and when you stretch it, and these ingredients, this medication basically can come out in a controlled rate. And all you need to do is just change the amount that you're stretching. So in terms of using this, for example, as a bandage, if you put an oxetic bandage on something which has been recently injured, then as the swelling increases, then your injury would basically result in swelling up and opening up of your bandage. So it will result in a release of your medication. And as the injury starts healing itself, then the material does not remain in a stretched state, so the pores close up again, and the material, the medication would remain there.
The idea that you can have these materials at the nano level, mm-hmm. and at a sort of middle size level, and at the large level, why does that happen? How is it that it happens like that?
Because basically, the reason why we have oxetic behavior, it's nothing supernatural or anything. It's just a relationship between the geometry of the material and the way the material deforms when it is stretched. So basically everything, I mean, if you take a foam, if you take a nanostructured material, if you look closely enough, you will find that there is like a structure. So what you need is that you need particular shapes of your structure, and that when you stretch them, they have to deform in a particular way. So provided these two ingredients are there, you have the right structure and you have the right deformation mechanism, then you can get your system to be oxetic. So there is no need to do this at the micro level or the macro level. Provided you have the right structure and the right deformation mechanism, then you find your system can become larger when you stretch it. In fact, I don't really like to speak about oxetic materials. I prefer to speak about oxetic systems, because there are a number of, if you do something on a macro scale, then it is usually cheaper to manufacture it in that way than you manufacturing a real nanoscale oxetic. But you still get the same properties, you still get the same advantages.
I know that this is a material, or systems have, we've known about them, you were saying, for some time. But you yourself, in collaboration with others, have been actually working on a particular methodology within this area. Perhaps you could just talk a little bit about that, because it was a very exciting moment, because your work was actually promoted in a very high-level scholarly journal abroad.
What we try and do here is to try and understand why these materials behave in this way. So our group, our research in Malta, is mainly of a theoretical basis. We try and understand through looking, to try and produce models to explain what is happening. So our job here is to either take a naturally occurring material and try and explain, create a model, how this material behaves in this way, or else go the other way around. So sort of we create the model first, and then we see how can we use this model to create something which is really occurring. But our main work, our work is very, very fundamental, because what we do is we try and understand the reasons why our materials, our structures are behaving in this way. And this is very, very important, because unless you can actually understand what is really happening, then you cannot move further. So our work is of a very fundamental nature, so it makes it very useful in the field of auxetics. It is also rather inexpensive to actually do work which is such of a fundamental nature, because it's mainly modeling. So because of our obvious limitations, it is easier to do modeling than to do actual experimental work, although we are now moving in the direction of actually doing experiments. But we were very lucky, because I entered into this field at a stage where there was still enough space to do some very fundamental work.
And again, as we were saying with Dr. Camilleri before, partners are really important with something like this. I know that you've been working with people on the issue.
Indeed. And like Dr. Camilleri, we do work both internally in terms of internal collaboration. We've had some very interesting projects, for example, with the Department of Mechanical Engineering, with Martin Muscat, where we were looking at, for example, using our materials in shells, in pressure vessels. People like Professor Alex Sorpiano were looking at auxetics in buildings, whether we can use these our models to create structures on a large scale, which basically you can expand them. So imagine you have like a tent, which is in a compressed shape, and you pull it up and it opens up into a large tent. We are also doing some work at the moment locally with some companies, in particular with Method. But we also have very good international partners. In particular, we work very closely with Exeter and Bolton in the United Kingdom, who have got a lot of expertise in this field, who were recently involved in a very large FP6 project led by the University of Bristol. And universities like Catania, Poland, Polish universities, Polish institutions, so quite a number of partners.
And when will you be researching, doing some work with Dr. Camilleri? I gather that you're going to be doing something together.
In fact, we are trying. Because another area which I work on is on materials with a negative thermal expansion. Now, this is something else which is very unusual. So these are materials which, when you heat them up, they become smaller, because usually we're accustomed to something, you heat it up and it expands. Mm. So we also work on some materials and structures which you heat them up and they become smaller. And these are very often used in the making of composites, where you can control how much a material expands or contracts, because when you put in these negative thermal expansion materials, then you can reduce the extent by which the normal material, the bulk material, would have increased in size when you heat it. And unfortunately, one of the biggest challenges that dentists find is the fact that our mouth is a place where you have very big changes in temperature. I mean, you can be eating ice cream, and a few minutes afterwards you're eating, you're drinking a very hot coffee. So you can have anything between 0 degrees and 80, 90 degrees in your mouth within very short periods of time. And that is very demanding on your materials. So one of the interesting applications of work we do is, in fact, in dental applications, where we can use materials with a negative thermal expansion and you can combine them with conventional materials so that you can reduce the amounts of the thermal expansion of materials that are then used as dental fillers.
So, Dr. Camilleri, this is something that is theoretical. You're going to be looking into the theory, but then very much with a practical application.
Yes, eventually, yes. I mean, we'll start first with giving a good thought at modeling of the material first. Then eventually, I mean, our main problem with our dental materials, as I said, besides getting them wet, is that our materials can either expand, depending on the material for use, or shrink. So if we're manipulating these new materials, we will have to compensate for the shrinkage or expansion, producing a material which is more stable. The more stable the material, the less problems obviously we'll get, because our main enemy is bacterial ingress within the tooth. Once you get bacteria inside the tooth, obviously that will lead to failure of restoration and eventually tooth extraction.
And in this particular area, again, the funding, we're talking money now, where will the money come from?
Good question. We were very lucky because, first of all, our research was very well funded, both locally and internationally. We had a very good project funded by the EU, an FP6 project, which we got about €250,000 for the University of Malta to work on these systems. We were designing basically structures with a chiral geometry, which have got very interesting applications, even in aeronautics and ship industries and naval applications. And we were also funded quite well by the Malta Council for Science and Technology, by MCST, because we had we were the winners of two major grants, one in 1994 and one last year in 2008. For example, in the last one, this will make it possible for us to move over to experimental work, because so far our main input into this field was in terms of theory. But because of the money that we got from MCST, we have been able to purchase some new equipment, and basically we are now working on a new way of making oxidic foams. Because as I said before, the only way that we know how to do them is basically by heating them in a compressed state. We are developing a process at the moment where we don't do that and we get the same results, which is very interesting.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating speaking to you both. Thank you very, very much, Dr. José Camilleri and Professor Joseph Grima. This is a lesson to mere mortals like myself who don't really understand much about science. The common sense has to be left at the door, and a counterintuitive, open mind has to really be used when faced with these very interesting and very important new materials, new discussions, new ways of doing things. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.